to the library to talk about it. What was the crew like? What did they do? Where did they go while in town? What else did they film? Can you believe it? Can you believe it? Can you believe it? Japanese television put Dewey over the top. Even today, when locals talk about Dewey, the conversation always comes around to, "And those Japanese people came here to Spencer to film him." What more needs to be said? Spencer residents aren't the only ones who remember that documentary. After it aired, we received several letters from Japan and 40 requests for Dewey postcards. Our library website tallies the origin of visitors, and every month since the documentary aired in the summer of 2004, Japan has been the second most popular country of origin after the United States. More than 150,000 visitors in 3 years. Somehow, I don't think they're interested in checking out books. But the Japanese invasion wasn't the only special thing that happened during the summer of 2003, at least for me. The previous year, Scott had proposed to Jody on Christmas Eve at my parents' house. She asked me to take charge of the flowers and decorations, since both were hobbies of mine. But there was something nagging at me. My sister, Val, was Jody's maid of honor, and I knew the two of them were discussing dresses. I wanted the dress to be special. I wanted to be a part of it. I called Jody and said, "I've dreamed all my life of helping you pick out your wedding dress. Val has two daughters of her own. She'll have her chance." "I would love to do this with you, Mom." My heart leaped into my throat. I could tell by the quiver in Jody's voice that she felt it too. We are both sentimental fools. But I'm also practical. "You narrow down the choices," I told her. "When you find half a dozen you like, I'll drive there to help you make the final decision." Jody could never make up her mind about clothes. She kept most of her garments in their original boxes because she was always returning them. Jody lived more than 3 hours away in Omaha, Nebraska, and I didn't want to kill myself making that drive every weekend for the next 6 months. Jody shopped for dresses with her friends. Weeks later, I drove to Omaha to help her make the final decision. We couldn't decide. Then we spotted one she'd never tried on. As soon as we saw her in the dress, we knew. Jody and I stood in the dressing room together and cried. We went shopping together a few months later, and she chose a beautiful dress for me. Then, Jody called me and said, "I just bought a dress for Grandma." "That's funny," I told her. "I was in Des Moines on library business, and I bought her one too." When we got together, we realized we had bought Mom the same dress, on the same day, at the same time. We really laughed about that one. The wedding took place in July at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Milford, Iowa. Jody planned the wedding from Omaha. I did the legwork. Jody and I were perfectionists. We didn't want a flower out of place. Trudy and Barb were nervous wrecks when we decorated Mom and Dad's garage for the reception, but they did a beautiful job. When they finished, it didn't even resemble a garage. The next day, we decorated the church, then the restaurant for the rehearsal dinner. There were 37 guests at the wedding, just family members and close friends. My friends didn't attend the ceremony. They were in a back room heating butterflies. The butterflies were supposed to be kept on ice in suspended animation, then warmed up and awoken 15 minutes before being called upon to fly. Faith called herself the BBBBB, the beautiful big-boobed butterfly babysitter. But she took her job quite seriously. She was so nervous about the butterflies. The night before the wedding, she took them to Trudy's house in Worthington, Minnesota, an hour away, and kept them beside her bed. When the guests came out of the wedding, Scott's parents handed each of them an envelope. My brother, Mike, who was standing next to the bride, immediately started squeezing. Jody gave him a look. "What?" Mike said. Is it alive?
Well, it was.
I read the legend of the butterflies, which have no voices. When released, they rise to heaven and whisper our wishes to God. When the guests opened their envelopes, butterflies of all sizes and colors flew up into a beautiful, clear blue sky, a whisper away from God. Most of them disappeared on the wind. Three settled back down on Jody's dress. One stayed on her bridal bouquet for more than an hour. The letter Jody sent after the honeymoon said it all. Thank you, Mom. It was the perfect wedding. No 8 words could ever make me happier. I had been mentally preparing for Dewey's death since he was 14 years old. His colon condition and public living arrangement, according to Dr. Esterly, made it unlikely Dewey would live longer than a dozen years. But Dewey had a rare combination of genetics and attitude. By the time Dewey was 17, I had nearly stopped thinking about his death. I accepted it not so much as inevitable, but as another milestone down the road. Since I didn't know the location of the marker or what it would look like when we got there, why spend time worrying about it? That is to say, I enjoyed our days together, and during our evenings apart, I looked no further than the next morning. I realized Dewey was losing his hearing when he stopped responding to the word bath. For years, that word had sent him into a scamper. The staff would be talking, and someone would say, "I had to clean my bathtub last night." Bam! Dewey was gone. Every time. "That isn't about you, Dewey." But he wasn't listening. Say the word bath, or brush, or comb, or scissors, or doctor, or vet, and Dewey disappeared. When I was away on library business or out sick, as I often was with my immune system so compromised by surgeries, Kay took care of Dewey. If he needed something, even comfort or love, and I wasn't around, he went to Kay. She may have been distant at first, but after all those years she had become his second mother, the one who loved him but wouldn't tolerate his bad habits. If Kay and I were standing together and even thought the word water, Dewey ran. Then, one day, someone said, "bath," and he didn't run. He still ran when I thought bath, but not at the word. So I started to watch him more closely. Sure enough, he had stopped running away every time a truck rumbled by in the alley behind the library. The sound of the back door opening used to send him sprinting to sniff the incoming boxes. Now, he wasn't moving at all. He wasn't jumping at sudden loud noises, such as someone setting down a large reference volume too fast, and he wasn't coming as often when patrons called. That, however, might not have had much to do with hearing. When you get older, the simple things are suddenly not so simple. A touch of arthritis, discomfort in the muscles. You thin out and stiffen up. In both cats and humans, the skin gets less elastic, which means more flaking and irritation and less ability to heal. These are not small things when your job is, essentially, to be petted all day. Dewey still greeted everyone at the front door. He still searched out laps, but on his own terms. He had arthritis in his back left hip, and jostling him in the wrong place or picking him up the wrong way would cause him to limp away in pain. More and more in the late morning and afternoon, he sat on the circulation desk, where he was protected by staff. He was supremely confident in his beauty and popularity. He knew patrons would come to him. He looked so regal. A lion surveying his kingdom. He even sat like a lion, with his paws crossed in front of him and his back legs tucked underneath, a model of dignity and grace. The staff started quietly suggesting that patrons be gentle with Dewey, more aware of his comfort. Joy, who spent the most time out front with the patrons, became very protective of him. She often brought her nieces and nephews to see Dewey, even on her days off, so she knew how rough people could be. "These days," she would tell the patrons, "Dewey prefers a gentle pat on the head." Even the elementary school children understood Dewey was an old man now, and they were sensitive to his needs. This was his second generation of Spencer children, the children of the children Dewey had gotten to know as a kitten. So the parents made sure their kids were well behaved. When the children touched him gently, Dewey would lie against their legs, or if they were sitting on the floor, on their laps. But he was more cautious than he used to be, and loud noise or rough petting often drove him away. "That's all right, Dewey. Whatever you need." After years of trial and error, we had finally found our finicky cat an acceptable cat bed. It was small, with white fake fur sides and an electric warmer in the bottom. We kept it in front of the wall heater outside my office door. Dewey loved nothing more than lounging in his bed, in the safety of the staff area, with the heating pad turned all the way up. In the winter, when the wall heater was on, he got so warm he had to throw himself over the side and roll around on the floor. His fur was so hot you couldn't even touch it. He would lie on his back for 10 minutes with all his legs spread out, venting heat. If a cat could pant, Dewey would have been panting. As soon as he was cool, he climbed back into his bed and started the process all over again. Heat wasn't Dewey's only indulgence. I may have been a sucker for Dewey's whims, but now our assistant children's librarian, Donna, was spoiling him even more than I did. If Dewey didn't eat his food right away, she heated it in the microwave for him. If he still didn't eat it, she threw it out and opened another can. Donna didn't trust ordinary flavors. Why should Dewey eat gizzards and toes? Donna drove to Milford, 15 miles away, because a little store there sold exotic cat food. I remember duck. Dewey was fond of that, for a week. She tried lamb, too, but as usual, nothing stuck for very long. Donna kept trying new flavor after new flavor, and new can after new can. Oh, how she loved that cat! Despite our best efforts, though, Dewey was thinning down. So, at his next checkup, Dr. Frank prescribed a series of medicines to fatten him up. That's right. Despite the dire health warnings, Dewey had outlasted his old nemesis, Dr. Esterly, who retired at the end of 2002 and donated his practice to a nonprofit animal advocacy group. Along with the pills, Dr. Frank gave me a pill shooter, which, theoretically, shot the pills far enough down Dewey's throat that he couldn't spit them out. But Dewey was smart. He took his pills so calmly, I thought, good, we made it. That was easy. That's when he snuck behind a shelf somewhere and coughed it back up. I found little white pills all over the library. I didn't force Dewey's medicine on him. He was 18. If he didn't want medicine, he didn't have to take it. Instead, I bought him a container of yogurt and started giving him a lick every day. That opened the floodgates. Kay started giving him bites of cold cuts out of her sandwiches. Joy started sharing her ham sandwich, and pretty soon Dewey was following her to the kitchen whenever he saw her walk through the door with a bag in her hand. One day, Sharon left a sandwich unwrapped on her desk. When she came back a minute later, the top slice of bread had been carefully turned over and placed to the side. The bottom slice of bread was sitting exactly where it had been, untouched. But all the meat was gone. After Thanksgiving of 2005, we discovered Dewey loved turkey, so the staff loaded up on holiday scraps. We tried to freeze them, but he could always tell when the turkey wasn't fresh. Dewey never lost his keen sense of smell. That's one reason I scoffed when Sharon offered Dewey a bite of garlic chicken, her favorite microwavable lunch. I told her, no way Dewey is going to eat garlic.
he ate every bite. Who was this cat? For 18 years, Dewey ate nothing but specific brands and flavors of cat food. Now, it seemed, he'd eat anything. I thought, if we can fatten Dewey up on human food, why not? Isn't that better than a pill? I bought him Braunschweiger, a cold loaf of sliced liver sausage many people around here consider a delicacy. Braunschweiger is about 80% pure fat. If anything would fatten Dewey up, it was Braunschweiger. He wouldn't touch it. What Dewey really wanted, we discovered accidentally, was Arby's beef and cheddar sandwiches. He gobbled them down, inhaled them. He didn't even chew the beef, he just sucked it in. I don't know what was in those sandwiches, but once he started on Arby's beef and cheddar, Dewey's digestion improved. His constipation decreased dramatically. He started eating 2 cans of cat food a day, and because the fast food was so salty, he was slurping down a full dish of water as well. He even started using the litter box on his own. But Dewey didn't have a couple owners. He had hundreds, and most of them couldn't see the improvements. All they saw was the cat they loved getting thinner and thinner. Dewey never hesitated to play up his condition. He would sit on the circulation desk, and whenever someone approached to pet him, he would whine. They always fell for it. "What's the matter, Dewey?" He led them to the entrance to the staff area, where they could see his food dish. He'd look forlornly at the food, then back at them, and with his big eyes full of sorrow, drop his head. "Vicky, Dewey's hungry. He has a can of food in the bowl, but he doesn't like it. That's his second flavor this morning. I threw the first can away an hour ago. But he's crying. Look at him. He just flopped down on the floor. We can't just give him cans of food all day. What about something else? He ate an Arby's sandwich this morning. Look at him. He's so thin. You guys have to feed him more. We're taking good care of him. But he's so thin. Can't you give him something for me?" I could, except Dewey did the same thing yesterday, and the day before that, and the day before that. In fact, you're the 5th person he's hit with the starving cat routine today. Now, how was I going to tell a patron that? I always gave in, which of course just encouraged more bad behavior. I think Dewey enjoyed the taste of food more when he knew I didn't want to give it to him. Let's call it the taste of victory. As Dewey entered old age, the kindness of Spencer Public Library patrons really began to show. Friends and visitors alike were gentler around him. They talked to him more and were attentive to his needs, much as you would be to an older relative at a family reunion. Occasionally, someone would comment that he looked weak, or thin, or dirty, but I knew their concern was a manifestation of their love. "What's wrong with his fur?" was probably the most common question. "Nothing," I told them. "He's just old." It's true, Dewey's fur had lost much of its luster. It was no longer radiant orange, but a dull copper. It was also increasingly matted, so much so I couldn't keep up with a simple brushing. I took Dewey to Dr. Frank, who explained that as cats aged, the barbs on their tongues wore down. Even if they licked themselves regularly, they couldn't do an efficient job grooming because there was nothing to separate the fur. Tangles and mats were just another symptom of old age. "As for these," Dr. Frank said, studying Dewey's clumped back end, "drastic measures are required. I think we better shave." When she was done, poor Dewey was fuzzy on one end, bare on the other. He looked like he was wearing a big mink coat and no pants. A few members of the staff laughed when they saw him, because it was a hilarious sight. But they didn't laugh long. The humiliation on Dewey's face stopped that. He hated it. Just hated it. He walked away very fast for a few steps, then sat down and tried to hide his rear end. Then he got up, walked quickly away, and sat down again. Start, stop. Start, stop. He finally made it back to his bed, buried his head in his paws, and curled up beneath his favorite toy, Marty Mouse. For days we found him with his top half sticking out into an aisle and his back end hidden in a bookshelf. But Dewey's health was no laughing matter. The staff didn't talk about it, but I knew they were worried. They were afraid they would come in one morning and find Dewey dead on the floor. It wasn't his death that worried some of them, I realized, but the thought of having to deal with it themselves. Or, even worse, having to make a decision in a health crisis. Between my own health issues and my trips to Des Moines on state library business, I was frequently out of the library. Dewey was my cat, and everyone knew it. The last thing they wanted was to have the life of my cat in their hands. "Don't worry," I told them. "Just do what you think is best for Dewey. You can't do anything wrong." I couldn't promise the staff nothing would happen while I was away, but I told them, "I know this cat. I know when he is healthy, a little sick, and really sick. If he's really sick, trust me, he's going to the vet. I'll do whatever it takes." Besides, Dewey wasn't sick. He still jumped up and down from the circulation desk, so I knew his arthritis wasn't too bad. His digestion was better than ever, and he still loved the company of patrons. But it took patience to care for an elderly cat, and frankly, some of the staff didn't think that was their job. Slowly, as Dewey aged, his support peeled away. First those in town with different agendas, then some of the fence sitters, then a few patrons who wanted only an attractive, active cat, and finally, the staff members who didn't want the burden of geriatric care. That doesn't mean I wasn't blindsided by the October 2006 library board meeting. I was expecting a typical discussion of the state of the library, but the meeting soon turned into a referendum on Dewey. A patron had mentioned he wasn't looking well. Perhaps the board suggested we should get him some medical help? At his recent checkup, I told them, Dr. Frank discovered hyperthyroidism. It's just another symptom of age, like his arthritis, his dry skin, and the black age spots on his lips and gums. Dr. Frank prescribed a medication that, thank goodness, doesn't have to be taken orally. I rub it in his ear. Dewey has really perked up. "And don't worry," I reminded them, "we're paying for the medicine with donations and my own money. Not a single penny of city money is ever spent on Dewey's care." "Is hyperthyroidism serious?"
"Yes, but it's treatable."
"Will this medicine help his fur?"
"Dullness isn't a disease. It's a function of age, like gray hair on a human."
They should understand. There wasn't a head in the room without a few gray hairs.
"What about his weight?"
I explained his diet in detail, from the obsessiveness with which Donna and I changed his cat food to the Arby's beef and cheddar sandwiches. "But he doesn't look good."
They kept coming back to that. Dewey didn't look good. Dewey was hurting the image of the library.
I knew they meant well, that they were interested in finding the best solution for everyone, but I couldn't understand their thinking. It was true, Dewey didn't look as appealing. Everybody ages. 80-year-olds don't look like 20-year-olds, and they shouldn't.
We live in a throwaway culture that stashes older people away and tries not to look at them. They have wrinkles, they have age spots, they don't walk well and their hands shake. Their eyes are watery, or they drool when they eat, or they burp in their pants too much. Jody's phrase from when she was 2 years old. We don't want to see that. Even the accomplished elderly, even the people who gave their whole lives, we want them out of sight and out of mind. But maybe older people and old cats have something to teach us, if not about the world, then about ourselves. Why don't you take Dewey home to live with you? I know he visits you on holidays.
I had thought of that, but dismissed it long ago. Dewey could never be happy living at my house. I was gone too much, between work and meetings. He hated to be alone. He was a public cat. He needed people around him. He needed the library around him to be happy.
We've had complaints, Vicky, don't you understand? Our job is to speak for the citizens of this town.
The board seemed ready to say the town didn't want Dewey anymore.
I knew that was ridiculous, because I saw the community's love for Dewey every day. I had no doubt the board had received a few complaints, but there had always been complaints.
Now, with Dewey not looking his best, the voices were louder. But that didn't mean the town had turned on Dewey.
One thing I'd learned over the years was that the people who loved Dewey, who really wanted and needed him, weren't the ones with the loudest voices. They were often the ones with no voices at all.
If this had been the board 20 years ago, I realized, we would never have been able to adopt Dewey.
Thank God, I thought to myself, thank you, God, for past boards.
And even if what the board thought was true, even if the majority of the town had turned its back on Dewey, didn't we nonetheless have the duty to stand by him? Even if 5 people cared, wasn't that enough? Even if nobody cared, the fact remained that Dewey loved the town of Spencer. He would always love Spencer. He needed us. We couldn't just toss him out because looking at him, older and weaker, no longer made us proud.
There was another message from the board, too, and it came through loud and clear. Dewey is not your cat. He's the town's cat. We speak for the town, so it's our decision. We know what's best.
I won't argue one fact. Dewey was Spencer's cat.
Nothing has ever been truer.
But he was also my cat. And finally, in the end, Dewey was a cat.
At that meeting, I realized that in many people's minds, Dewey had gone from being a flesh-and-blood animal with thoughts and feelings to being a symbol, a metaphor, an object that could be owned. Library board members loved Dewey as a cat. Kathy Greiner, the president, always carried treats in her pocket for Dewey, but they still couldn't separate the animal from the legacy.
And I have to admit, there was another thought going through my mind. I'm getting older, too. My health isn't the best. Are these people going to throw me out on my ear, too?
Maybe you think I love Dewey too much, I told them. Maybe you think my love clouds my judgment. But trust me, I'll know when it's time. I've had animals all my life. I've put them down. It's hard, but I can do it. The very last thing I want, the very last thing, is for Dewey to suffer.
A board meeting can be a freight train. And this one pushed me off to the side like a cow on the tracks. Someone suggested a committee to make decisions about Dewey's future. I knew the people on that committee would mean well. I knew they would take their duty seriously and do what they thought best. But I couldn't let that happen. I just couldn't. The board was discussing how many people should be on this Dewey Death Watch committee when one member, Sue Hitchcock, spoke up.
This is ridiculous, she said. I can't believe we're even discussing this. Vicky has been at the library for 25 years. She's been with Dewey for 19 years. She knows what she's doing. We should all trust Vicky's judgment.
Thank God for Sue Hitchcock. As soon as she spoke, the train jumped the tracks and the board backed off.
Yes, yes, they muttered. You're right. Too soon, too much. If his condition worsens...
I was devastated. It stung me to the heart that these people had even suggested taking Dewey away from me. And they could have done it. They had the power.
but they didn't. Somehow, we had won a victory. For Dewey, for the library, for the town, for me. I'll always remember Christmas 2005, the year before that horrible meeting, when Dewey was 18. Jody and Scott stayed at my house. They had twins now, Nathan and Hannah, a year and a half old. Dewey sprawled on the sofa, pressed against Jody's hip. It was the end of one thing, the beginning of the next. But for that week, we were all together. Dewey's love for Jody had never diminished. She was still his great romantic affair. Whenever he got a chance that Christmas, Dewey stuck by her side. But with so many people around, especially the children, and with so much going on, he was more content than ever to just watch. He got along well with Scott, not a hint of jealousy. And he loved the twins. I replaced my glass coffee table with a cushioned ottoman when my grandchildren were born, and Dewey spent most of Christmas week sitting on that ottoman. Hannah and Nathan would toddle up and pet him all over. Dewey was cautious around toddlers now. In the library, he slunk away when they tried to approach him. But he sat with the twins, even when they petted him the wrong way and messed up his fur. Hannah kissed him 100 times a day. Nathan accidentally knocked him on the head. One afternoon, Hannah poked Dewey in the face while trying to pet him. Dewey didn't even react. This was my grandchild, Jody's child. Dewey loved us, so he loved Hannah, too. Dewey was so calm that year. That was the biggest difference in old man Dewey. He knew how to avoid trouble. He still attended meetings, but he knew how far to push and which lap to choose. In September 2006, just a few weeks before the board meeting, a program at the library brought in almost 100 people. I figured Dewey would hide in the staff area, but there he was, mingling as always. He was like a shadow moving among the guests, often unnoticed but somehow there at the end of a patron's hand each time someone reached to pet him. There was a rhythm to his interactions that seemed the most natural and beautiful thing in the world. After the program, Dewey climbed into his bed above Kay's desk, clearly exhausted. Kay came over and gave him a gentle scratch on the chin. I knew that touch, that quiet look. It was a thank you, the one you give an old friend or a spouse after you've watched them across a crowded room and realized how wonderful they are and how lucky you are to have them in your life. I half expected her to say, "That'll do, Cat, that'll do," like the farmer in the movie Babe. But this time, Kay left all the words unsaid. 2 months later, in early November, Dewey's gait became a bit unsteady. He started peeing excessively, sometimes on the paper outside his litter box, which he had never done before. But he wasn't hiding. He was still jumping up and down from the circulation desk. He still interacted with patrons. He didn't seem to be in pain. I called Dr. Frank, and she advised me not to bring him in, but to watch him closely. One morning near the end of the month, Dewey wasn't waving. All those years, and I could count on one hand the number of times Dewey wasn't waving when I arrived in the morning. Instead, he was standing at the front door, just waiting for me. I ushered him to the litter box and gave him his can of cat food. He ate a few bites, then walked with me on our morning rounds. I was busy preparing for a trip to Florida. My brother Mike's daughter Natalie was getting married, and the whole family was going to be there. So I left Dewey with the staff for the rest of the morning. As always, he came in while I was working to sniff my office vent and make sure I was safe. The older he got, the more he protected the ones he loved. At 9:30, I went out for Dewey's breakfast of the moment, a Hardee's bacon, egg, and cheese biscuit. When I returned, Dewey didn't come running. I figured the deaf old boy didn't hear the door. I found him sleeping on a chair by the circulation desk, so I swung the bag a few times, floating the smell of eggs his way. He flew out of that chair into my office. I put the egg and cheese mush on a paper plate, and he ate 3 or 4 bites before curling up on my lap. At 10:30, Dewey attended story hour. As usual, he greeted every child. An 8-year-old girl was sitting on the floor with her legs crossed in the position we used to call Indian style. Dewey curled up on her legs and went to sleep. She petted him. The other children took turns petting him. Everyone was happy. After story hour, Dewey crawled into his fur-lined bed in front of the heater, which was running full blast, and that's where he was when I left the library at noon. I was going home for lunch, then picking up Dad and driving to Omaha to catch a flight the next morning. 10 minutes after I got home, the phone rang. It was Jan, one of our clerks. "Dewey's acting funny." "What do you mean, funny?" "He's crying and walking funny, and he's trying to hide in the cupboards. I'll be right down." Dewey was hiding under a chair. I picked him up, and he was shaking like the morning I found him. His eyes were big, and I could tell he was in pain. I called the veterinary office. Dr. Frank was out, but her husband, Dr. Beale, was in. He said, "Come right down." I wrapped Dewey in his towel. It was a cold day, end of November. Dewey snuggled against me immediately. By the time we arrived at the vet's office, Dewey was down on the floor of my car by the heater, shaking with fear. I cradled him in my arms and held him against my chest. That's when I noticed poop sticking out of his behind. What a relief! It wasn't serious. It was constipation. I told Dr. Beale the problem. He took Dewey into the back room to clean out his colon and intestines. He also washed his back end, so Dewey came back wet and cold. He crawled from Dr. Beale's arms into mine and looked up at me with pleading eyes. "Help me." I could tell something still wasn't right. Dr. Beale said, "I can feel a mass. It's not feces." "What is it?" "He needs an X-ray." 10 minutes later, Dr. Beale was back with the results. There was a large tumor in Dewey's stomach, and it was pushing on his kidneys and intestines. That's why he had been peeing more, and it probably accounted for his peeing outside the litter box. "It wasn't there in September," Dr. Beale said, "which means it's probably an aggressive cancer. But we'd have to do invasive tests to find out for sure." We stood silently, looking at Dewey. I never suspected the tumor. Never. I knew everything about Dewey, all his thoughts and feelings, but he had kept this one thing hidden from me. "Is he in pain?" "Yes, I suspect he is. The mass is growing very fast, so it will only get worse."
"Is there anything you can give him for the pain?"
"No, not really." I was holding Dewey in my arms, cradling him like a baby. He hadn't let me carry him that way in 16 years. Now he wasn't even fighting it. He was just looking at me.
"Do you think he's in constant pain?"
"I can't imagine that he's not."
The conversation was crushing me, flattening me out, making me feel drawn, deflated, tired. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Somehow, I had believed Dewey was going to live forever. I called the library staff and told them Dewey wasn't coming home. Kay was out of town, Joy was off duty, several others came down to say their goodbyes. Instead of going to Dewey, though, Sharon walked right up and hugged me. Thank you, Sharon. I needed that. Then I hugged Donna and thanked her for loving Dewey so much. Donna was the last to say her goodbyes. Someone said, "I don't know if I want to be here when they put him to sleep." "That's fine," I said. "I'd rather be alone with him." Dr. Beale took Dewey into the back room to insert the IV, then brought him back in a fresh blanket and put him in my arms. I talked to Dewey for a few minutes. I told him how much I loved him, how much he meant to me, how much I didn't want him to suffer. I explained what was happening and why. I rewrapped his blanket to make sure he was comfortable. What more could I offer him than comfort? I cradled him in my arms and rocked back and forth from foot to foot, a habit started when he was a kitten. Dr. Beale gave him the first shot, followed closely by the second. He said, "I'll check for a heartbeat." I said, "You don't need to. I can see it in his eyes." Dewey was gone. I was in Florida for 8 days. I didn't read the newspaper. I didn't watch television. I didn't take any phone calls. It was the best possible time to be away, because Dewey's death was hard, very hard. I broke down on the flight from Omaha and cried all the way to Houston. In Florida, I thought often of Dewey, alone, quietly, but also surrounded by the family that had always sustained me. I had no idea how far word of Dewey's death had spread. The next morning, while I sat crying on an airplane to Houston, the local radio station devoted their morning show to memories of Dewey. The Sioux City Journal ran a lengthy story and obituary. I don't know if that was the source, but the AP wire picked up the story and sent it around the world. Within hours, news of Dewey's death appeared on the CBS afternoon news break and on MSNBC. The library started getting calls. If I had been in the library, I would have been stuck answering questions from reporters for days. But nobody else on staff felt comfortable speaking to the media. The library secretary, Kim, gave a brief statement, which ended up in what I now think of as Dewey's public obituary, but that was all. It was enough. Over the next few days, that obituary ran in more than 270 newspapers. The response from individuals touched by Dewey was equally overwhelming. People in town received calls from friends and relatives all over the country who read about Dewey's death in the local newspaper or heard it on a local radio show. One local couple was out of the country and learned the news from a friend in San Francisco who read about his passing in the San Francisco Chronicle. Admirers set up a vigil in the library. Local businesses sent flowers and gifts. Sharon and Tony's daughter, Emmy, gave me a picture she had drawn of Dewey. It was two green circles in the middle of the page, with lines sticking out in all directions. It was beautiful, and Emmy beamed as I taped it to my office door. That picture was the perfect way for both of us to remember him. Gary Roma, director of the documentary about library cats, wrote me a long letter. It said, in part, "I don't know if I ever told you, but of all the many library cats I've met across the country, Dewey Readmore Books was my favorite. His beauty, charm, and playfulness were unique." Tomoko from Japanese Public Television wrote to tell us Dewey's death had been announced in Japan and that many were sad to hear he was gone. Marty Atun, who wrote the article for American Profile, wrote to say the Dewey story was still her favorite. It had been years, and Marty was now a contributing editor. It seemed so unlikely, given the hundreds of stories she had written, that Marty would remember a cat, much less still think of him fondly. But that was Dewey. He touched people so deeply. By the time I returned to my office, there were letters and cards stacked 4 feet high on my desk. I had more than 600 emails about Dewey waiting in my inbox. Many were from people who met him only once but never forgot him. Hundreds of others were from people who never met him. In the month after his death, I received more than 1,000 emails about Dewey from all around the world. We heard from a soldier in Iraq who had been touched by Dewey's death despite what he saw there every day, or perhaps because of it. We received a letter from a couple in Connecticut whose son was turning 11. His birthday wish was to release a balloon to heaven in Dewey's honor. We received numerous gifts and donations. A librarian at the Naval History Museum, for instance, donated 4 books in his memory. She had followed Dewey's story in library publications and read his obituary in the Washington Post. Our website, www.spencerlibrary.com, went from 25,000 hits a month to 189,922 in December, and the traffic didn't let up for most of the next year. Many people in town wanted us to hold a memorial service. I didn't want a memorial service. Nobody on staff did. But we had to do something. So on a cold Saturday in the middle of December, Dewey's admirers gathered at the library to remember one last time, at least officially, the friend who had had such an impact on their lives. The staff tried to keep it light, but despite our best efforts, tears were shed. 2 women cried the whole time. Crews from local television stations were filming the event. It was a nice thought, but the cameras seemed out of place. These were private thoughts among friends. We didn't want to share our words with the world. We also realized, as we stood there together, that words couldn't describe our feelings for Dewey. There was no easy way to say how special he was. We were here. The cameras were here. The world stood still around us. That said more than any words. Finally, a local school teacher said, "People say, what's the big deal? He was just a cat." But that's where they are wrong. Dewey was so much more. Everyone knew exactly what she meant. My moments with Dewey were more intimate. The staff had cleaned out his bowls and donated his food while I was away, but I had to give away his toys. I had to clean out his shelf, the Vaseline for his hairballs, the brush, the red skein of yarn he had played with all his life. I had to park my car and walk to the library every morning without Dewey waving at me from the front door. When the staff returned to the library after visiting Dewey for the last time, the space heater he had lain in front of every day wasn't working. Dewey had been lying in front of it that very morning, and it had been working fine. It was as if his death had taken away its reason to heat. Can a malfunctioning piece of equipment break your heart? It was 6 weeks before I could even think about having that heater repaired. I had Dewey cremated with one of his favorite toys, Marty Mouse, so he wouldn't be alone. The crematorium offered a mahogany box and bronze plaque, no charge, but it didn't seem right to display him. Dewey came back to his library in a plain plastic container inside a blue velvet bag. I put the container on a shelf in my office and went back to work. A week after his memorial service, I came out of my office a half hour before the library opened, long before any patrons arrived, and told Kay, "It's time." It was December, another brutally cold Iowa morning, just like the first morning, and so many in between. It was close to the shortest day of the year, and the sun wasn't yet up. The sky was still deep blue, almost purple, and there was no traffic on the roads. The only sound was the cold wind that had come all the way from the Canadian plains, whipping down the streets and out over the barren cornfields. We moved some rocks in the little garden out front of the library, looking for a place where the ground wasn't completely frozen. But the whole earth was frosted, and it took a while for Kay to dig the hole. The sun was peeking over the buildings on the far side of the parking lot, throwing the first shadows by the time I placed the remains of my friend in the ground, and said, simply, "You're always with us, Dewey. This is your home." Then Kay dropped in the first shovelful of dirt, burying Dewey's ashes forever outside the window of the children's library. As Kay moved the stones back over Dewey's final resting place, I looked up and saw the rest of the library staff in the window, silently watching us. Not much has changed in Northwest Iowa since Dewey died. With ethanol being the next big thing, more corn is in the ground than ever before. But there aren't more workers to grow it, just better technology and more machines. And, of course, more land. The library rolls on, cat-free for the first time since Ronald Reagan was president. After Dewey's death, we had almost 100 offers for new cats. We had offers from as far away as Texas, transportation included. The cats were cute, and most had touching survival stories, but there was no enthusiasm to take one. The library board wisely put a 2-year moratorium on cats in the library. They needed time, they said, to think through the issues. I had done all the thinking I needed. You can't bring back the past. But Dewey's memory will live on. I feel confident of that. Maybe at the library, where his portrait hangs beside the front door, above a bronze plaque that tells his story, a gift from one of Dewey's many friends. Maybe in the children who knew him, who will talk about him in decades to come with their own children and grandchildren. Maybe in this book. After all, that's why I'm writing it. For Dewey. Back in 2000, when Grand Avenue made the National Registry, Spencer commissioned a public art installation to serve as both a statement about our values and an entry point to our historic downtown. Two Chicago-area ceramic tile mosaic artists, Nina Smoot-Kane and John Pittman Weber, spent a year in the area, talking with us, studying our history, and observing our way of life. More than 570 residents, from young children to grandparents, consulted with the artists. The result is a mosaic sculpture called The Gathering of Time, of Land, of Many Hands. The Gathering is composed of 4 decorative pillars and 3 pictorial walls. The south wall is called The Story of the Land. It is a farm scene featuring corn and pigs, a woman hanging quilts on a clothesline, and a train. The north wall is The Story of Outdoor Recreation. It focuses on East and West Lynch Parks, our main municipal recreation areas, the fairgrounds on the northwest edge of town, and the lakes. The west wall is The Story of Spencer. It shows 3 generations gathering at Grandma's house. Just slightly to the left of center, in the upper half of the scene, is an orange cat sitting on the open pages of a book. The image is based on artwork submitted by a child. The Story of Spencer. Dewey is a part of it. Then, now, and forever. He will live longest, I know, in the collective memory of a town that never forgets where it's been, even as it looks ahead for where it's going. I told Jody, when Dewey was 14, I don't know if I'll want to keep working at the library after Dewey's gone. It was just a premonition, but now I understand what I meant. For as long as I can remember, when I pulled up every morning, the library was alive, with hope, with love, with Dewey waving at me from the front door. Now it's a dead building again. I feel the chill in my bones, even in the summer. Some mornings I don't want to bother. But then I turn on the lights, and the library flickers to life. The staff files in, the patrons follow. The middle-aged for books, the businessmen for magazines, the teenagers for computers, the children for stories, the elderly for support. The library is alive, and once again I have the best job on earth, at least until I get ready to leave in the evening and there's nobody begging for one more game of hide-and-seek. A year after Dewey's death, my health finally caught up with me. It was time, I knew, to move on with my life. The library was different without Dewey, and I didn't want my days to end that way. Empty, quiet, occasionally lonely. When I saw the book cart go past, the one Dewey used to ride on, it broke my heart. I missed him that much, and not just once in a while, but every day. I decided to retire. It was time. More than 125 people attended my retirement party, including many from out of town I hadn't spoken with in years. Dad read one of his poems. My grandkids sat with me to greet well-wishers. Two articles ran in the Spencer Daily Reporter thanking me for 25 years of service. Like Dewey, I was lucky. I got to leave on my own terms. Find your place. Be happy with what you have. Treat everyone well. Live a good life. It isn't about material things. It's about love. And you can never anticipate love. I learned those things from Dewey, of course. But as always, those answers seem too easy. All answers, except that I loved Dewey with all my heart, and he loved me in the same way, seem too easy. But let me try. When I was 3 years old, Dad owned a John Deere tractor. The tractor had a cultivator on the front, which is a long row of shovel-like blades, six on each side. The blades are raised a few inches off the dirt. You drive the handle forward to put them in the ground, where they chop into the soil, tossing fresh dirt against the corn rows. I was playing in the mud by the front wheel of that tractor one day, when Mom's brother came out after lunch, threw the clutch, and started driving. Dad saw what happened and started running, but Mom's brother couldn't hear him. The wheel knocked me down and shoved me into the blades. I was pushed along by the blades, passed from one to the other, until Mom's brother turned the wheel and the inside blade tossed me through the middle chute and left me lying face down behind the tractor. Dad scooped me up in one motion and ran me back to the porch. He looked me over in amazement, then held me in his arms for the rest of the day, rocking back and forth in our old rocking chair, crying on my shoulder and telling me, "You're all right. You're all right. Everything is all right." Eventually, I looked at him and said, "I cut my finger." I showed him the blood. I was bruised, but otherwise, that tiny cut was the only mark. That's life. We all go through the tractor blades every now and then. We all get bruised, and we all get cut. Sometimes the blades cut deep. The lucky ones come through with a few scratches, a little blood, but even that isn't the most important thing. The most important thing is having someone there to scoop you up, to hold you tight, and to tell you everything is all right. For years, I thought I had done that for Dewey. I thought that was my story to tell. And I had done that. When Dewey was hurt, cold, and crying, I was there. I held him. I made sure everything was all right. But that's only a sliver of the truth. The real truth is that for all those years, on the hard days, the good days, and all the unremembered days that make up the pages of the real book of our lives, Dewey was holding me. He's still holding me now. So thank you, Dewey. Thank you. Wherever you are.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.